What I intend to do is to talk a bit about the Sufi tradition of dream work, and then we have time for people to share dreams. That is the idea. So, in the back of this book, I've given a kind of outline of how Sufi dream work works. So I give a brief synopsis, so you don't have to buy the book. Sorry, it's called The Signs of God. It's my most recent book. It's about how to read the signs of God. There's a wonderful hadith. I get sidetracked already. There you go. There's a wonderful quotation from the Quran. We will show them our signs on the horizons and in themselves. And an important part of mystical life is learning how to read the signs of God, both in the outer world and in the inner world. And it's part of my belief that as a culture we've forgotten how to read the signs of God. And dream work is part of how to learn to read the signs of God in the inner world, in ourselves. How to read the signs of God in the outer world is another story. Okay, yeah, just come in if you like. Sit wherever you're comfortable on the floor. So I belong to a particular Sufi order, the Naqshbandiya order of Sufism. We have been doing dream work for about 700 or 800 years. So there is this whole tradition of spiritual dream work. The founder of our order, Bahauddin Naqshband, was renowned as an interpreter of dreams. And there is a tradition that he would never actually accept somebody as a disciple until either he or the person that had a dream which stated that that was necessary. So why do I say this? It's because there have been many schools of dream work that have sprung up in the last few years. And it's important to realize this is not something new. This is a very ancient spiritual tradition that has evolved over time. In this century, it has been adapted, and part of the adaption that Mrs. Tweedy started and that I continued was to give a Jungian perspective to it, because Jung had an understanding of the Western psyche, and the Western psyche is structured differently to the psyche of somebody who grows up in the East, who belongs to the collective of the East. The Western psyche is more individualized and has different symbols, and there is a different process of individuation and transformation that happens to the Western psyche. And Carl Jung is really the master in this century who described this process. He didn't invent it. He took it out of his alchemical tradition and Gnostic tradition. Those are the two Western traditions that describe the transformation, the alchemical opus of the Western psyche. And he described how it works in contemporary language. And part of the work that I was given was to incorporate this into the Sufi tradition of inner transformation, and particularly how it's expressed in dreams. I think when I was 29, I had a very simple dream in which I was told to read the works of Jung. So I started volume 5. Volume 1 to 4 aren't so important. And I read through to volume 16. And really then incorporated that wisdom into this Sufi tradition, because an important part of the inner journey is the process of psychological transformation and how the self is constellated in the midst of the psyche, how the shadow is transformed, and how that happens within a spiritual framework, within a spiritual tradition, because it is very, very important on the spiritual journey to have a solid psychological grounding. Otherwise, you can have mystical experiences that throw you off balance completely. And then it just takes a lot of time to reorientate yourself. And so psychological work, particularly in the tradition to which I belong, the Naqshbandi Sufi order, has always been important. And dream work is a way in which this process is imaged to us. One of the ways we work with our psyche is through dreams. But this is done within a spiritual context rather than in within a solely psychological context. There is a difference. And so I say part of my work has been to show how this process works, and I have written numbers of books about it, which you don't have to read. But it is important to know that the psychological work is grounded within a spiritual tradition, just as much as the spiritual work needs the grounding of a psychological basis. The two have to come together. And actually many different spiritual paths in the West now have begun to realize the importance of giving a psychological grounding to spiritual transformation. So there is this tradition of spiritual dream work stretching right back. And one of the most important things about dreams in our path is that they give us guidance. I feel very strongly we need all the guidance we can get. The particular Sufi order to which I belong, we're known as the silent Sufis, we have very few outer forms. There is very little outer guidance. Mrs. Tweedy used to call it do-it-yourself yoga. We are basically left alone most of the time. And there is no structure of stage one, stage two, stage three that you really have much idea about. Yes, the stages Andrew described do happen, but they happen in the depths of the psyche. So you don't identify with them, so the ego does not get hold of, well, I am at stage two, which is not a very helpful in the if you are trying to get rid of the ego. So dreams give us guidance. They point out the direction of the path. Often when somebody first comes to the path, they will have a dream that describes the whole of the journey that they are going to take. I always remember somebody who has struggled so much with the path since then. But when I first met him, he described this dream in which he was in a library, and the library was ordered, all the books were in order. And the librarian met him and showed him round the library and how all the books were in order until they came to the last shelf. And on the last shelf, two books were missing. And the librarian said, "Those are the last two books of love, you will replace them." And it's very simple, very clear, like a single note that is wrong. And when I see since then he has gone away from the group, he has come back, he has got depressed, he has given everything up, and gone through all of the ups and downs, he's still going through them. And yet, at the very beginning, there was this one note that was struck. The whole path for him was outlined very simply. And there, of course, that is when the whole journey is described, when the higher self tells us in these images of the unconscious, how the journey is going to be for us. And then of course you get smaller, dreams of guidance about how the journey is, what stage you are on, what is happening. And these are very, very helpful. And the thing I love about dreams is they tell us how our journey is. As I mentioned yesterday, come in please. Nobody should ever stay outside. You can sit over here if you like. It doesn't. No. The door is always open. You just have to walk through. There's a story of Rabia. Somebody asked Rabia, when will the beloved open the door? And Rabia said, the door was always open. You just had to walk through. So one also gets these dreams of guidance of just where you are at the moment. They're very, very helpful. But one of the problems is that in our culture we have developed one half of the brain, the logical, rational part. That's how we've been educated. And we've forgotten how to work with the symbolic part of the brain. And part of dream work is learning how to work with the symbolic part of the brain. And this has a lot to do with the feminine. In fact, One thing I have realized in working with dreams for many, many years now is it actually brings together the masculine and feminine within consciousness. You do learn to work in a way that unites the masculine and feminine aspects of consciousness. And for example, one of the first things you have to learn in working with dreams is learning how to listen. To listen with the inner ear. As a culture, we're not very good at listening. Things have to be spelled out to us. We don't even know how to read between the lines of life. We think our life is how it appears. No. As I mentioned yesterday, one of the first things you learn on the Sufi path is nothing is how it appears. Nothing is how it appears. Sometimes the greatest tragedy is the greatest joy. But there are subtleties to life. It is a very carefully scripted, like a carefully scripted orchestral work. And sometimes you have to listen to hear one note that is being played in the corner of the orchestra. And then you think, ah, that's what it means. And dream work teaches us to learn to read between the lines of life, to learn to listen with an inner ear. Not that wants something. In our culture, we are conditioned to want something. Wanting something gets in the way. We have to learn to listen empty, receptive. This is the feminine. This is the ancient art of work without doing. This, of course, comes from the Taoist tradition. The Taoists were masters at working without doing. One great Sufi, he says, infinitely attentive, infinitely relaxed, like the cat at the mouse hole. Always an eye or an ear, half open, half attentive. And if you want to work with dreams, you have to develop this capacity. Not, what does my dream want? I want guidance in my life. I'm very suspicious of people wanting guidance because it's usually about them. And as far as I understand, most guidance is not about us or not about the ego. It's about something else. So you learn to listen, to be receptive, to keep this other ear. You learn to develop this inner ear. And deeper than that is the whole tradition of catching the hint. There is a reason Sufis speak ambiguously. That things are very rarely spelled out. This is very difficult for American culture. In England, we are brought up to read what people are not saying, or to hear what people are not saying, because the English never say what they mean. You just have to read Jane Austen, you know? It is all about the nuances, all about the subtleties. But that is how the unconscious speaks to us, and that is also often how the self speaks to us. Because that is how the beloved speaks to us. He doesn't tell us what to do. Sometimes, when we really haven't listened, we have to get hit on the head. But it is about a cooperative venture. If we approach God or the beloved as children, we have to get told what to do. It is like this, you do this, this, and this. But Sufism is not about that, because God is our beloved. And in a love affair, when you are making love, you don't want to get told what to do. It's about the subtleties, it's about listening, it's about feeling, it's about the nuances. And you learn to listen, you learn to feel, you learn to be attentive. And then there is a movement, then there is a music, then there is a dialogue. And with the beloved, it is about dialogue. It is about listening. It is said that God very rarely directly instructs you. You get a hint. You get a suggestion. Because why? Because then you follow it, you go with it, you go with the current. You become part of the experience. And dream work prepares us. I think dream work is a wonderful preparation for learning to catch the hint. Because You begin to be aware of subtleties. In dreams, one thing is never one thing. One thing might mean this, or it might mean that, or it might mean something else. It can mean all sorts of things. In dreams, there are also different levels of meaning. This belongs, say, to the whole Sufi tradition of learning to listen to ambiguity, to learning to watch. And it is, I think, very important. This has to do with the whole business of the science of God. Learning to watch. How does it come? How is life relating to you? How is the unconscious relating to you? We are part of a whole interwoven pattern of inner and outer, of dance, of music. It comes to us usually from where we are not looking. Rumi says, he comes like a thief in the night. He comes through the back door. The beloved rarely comes to us straight on. Why? Because that is where all our conscious attitudes and patterns of defense are. That is where the eye is most constellated. So he comes when we're not looking, not in the way we would expect. Sometimes we don't even notice he was there until he has gone. And suddenly there is a strange aroma in the air, a strange imprint in our life. And we think, where did that come from? This is very difficult to our culture here. It's North American culture. Everything here is in your face. But the beloved isn't like that. He doesn't demand, he asks. The great Sufi Al-Halaj says, God said he can either come like a lure that seduces or like violence that forces. And he prefers seduction to violence. That's why you should never trust a Sufi. There's a lovely dream actually somebody had years ago. It's one of my favorite dreams about the path. I am in a green field embracing a man. Looking up, I see that the scene is being filmed. It is a scene for a movie. I leave the field and walk down a dusty road. Along the road towards me walk two men. They are well-dressed travelers. When I meet, I realize that they are gamblers, father and son. And they offer to play cards with me at $25 a hand. I say that I will play, but only at $5 a hand, and I want a new pack of cards. The son produces a new pack of cards from his pocket, and with the old man watching, we play one hand. I win this hand. Now, when I heard this dream, I laughed and laughed and laughed for about 10 minutes. There were about 300 people in the audience. I didn't mind. I couldn't believe it. So I will describe, tell you the joke. I'm in a green field embracing a man. This is, you know, a woman's, you know, idealized relationship. I'm so sure most of you have one somewhere in your mind. Looking up, I see that the scene is being filmed. You know, it's all a movie. You know that place, time you get to when you realize your whole life is a movie and you're acting a part? You know, and maybe that scene has been filmed over and over again. Maybe your mother played the same part. And suddenly you've had enough. It is a scene for a movie. I leave the field and walk down a dusty road. And the dusty road is an ancient, ancient image of the path. This is the dusty road, not the well-paved highway. No, the dusty road. Be in this world as if you are a traveler, a passerby, for this is not home. Sometimes you sit under the shade of a tree or by a lake with your clothes and shoes full of dust. Be always a traveler, for this is not home. That is a famous hadith. And this is the path, the dusty road. Along the road towards me walk two men. They are well-dressed travelers. So these are the travelers who are coming to meet the dreamer. When we meet, I realize that they are gamblers, father and son. And of course, a gambler is an ancient image of the Sufi. The founder of our order, Bahauddin Naqshband, he said, he learned more about spiritual life from a gambler than anyone else. Because there was somebody who was prepared to risk everything, even his own head, for the next roll of the dice. This is not a path of safety. There is no surety. Maybe you do practices for 20 years and get nothing. Maybe it didn't work. Maybe it was the wrong path. Maybe the teacher failed you, betrayed you. There is no guarantee, except if you are lucky, you lose everything. So these two Sufis walk towards a dreamer, father and son. They are gamblers, and they offer to play cards with me at $25 a hand. You see, she's being invited into this ancient ritual of Sufism. But she is very sensible. $25, a bit much. Let's play $5 a hand, you see? Very sensible woman. I know her, she's very sensible. And also she wants a new pack of cards, you see? She doesn't trust them. She doesn't trust that old, you know, worn pack of cards that's been marked. Each one has been marked. She gets a new pack of cards. The son produces a new pack of cards from his pocket, and with the old man watching, we play one hand. I win this hand. And that was when I laughed. Because it is the oldest trick in the book, my friends. Oldest trick in the book. You win the first hand. You win the second hand. You win the third hand, and then you are hooked. Then the trouble begins. We call it the honeymoon period. Lasts 6 months if you are lucky. You get these wonderful experiences in meditation. There's somebody I know, he's been meditating for years, and he said, the first time he came to this path, he did this silent meditation. And his mind was totally still. First time in his life, mind totally still. He said, hey, this is a good meditation. Just do it once, mind is still. 10 years later, hasn't been still again. Son produces a new pack of cards from his pocket. And what the dreamer, of course, didn't realize, this is the son she is playing with, the apprentice. The father has been cheating at cards for about 6 or 7 centuries. He knows how to deal any hand there is. You get great hands, you think you are going to win, and you lose. You get terrible hands, all twos or something, and you win. It's always different, and you're always cheating. You are always cheated, always. That I can assure you. It's never fair. The cards are always stacked against you. The teacher always has 5 aces up his pocket, up his sleeve. Always. That is the tradition. He can read your mind. Or maybe you think he can read your mind and he's not even interested in your mind. So you can take that as a warning dream if you like. There are such things as warning dreams. Look out, look out. It's such a crazy path. It's so full of... Sufi is a trickster. He tricks you. He tricks your mind, he tricks your psyche. You fall in love with an invisible beloved. What is a greater trick than that? You give everything for nothing. That's why I like the Zen tradition. This particular Naqshbandi path is very similar to Zen. You have to learn to sit without sitting, to walk without walking, to meditate without meditating. And at the beginning of the Zen tradition, they say, you are going to get nothing. There is nothing to realize. There is nowhere to get. And you still sit there 8 hours a day for 10 years. You see, you get calm too. Sufis also, there is nothing to get, everything to lose. There are such things as teaching dreams. I mentioned yesterday on this particular path, we meet in the night on the level of the soul. And a lot of Sufi teaching is reflected from soul to soul. And you can wake up with these teaching dreams. They are not psychological, they are straightforward teaching dreams. And one person was told in a dream, what is the last greatest secret? And the dreamer answers, but the answer comes as if something speaks without me interfering. The last greatest secret is that there is none, and because of that it is kept the greatest secret. Everybody here, you all expect you're going to get something, don't you? Come on, own up. You all want something. Some sort of experience, even maybe whatever this strange word is, enlightenment. You want something. I had a friend who used to work for a company here. It was actually here in North Carolina. It was a very well-known company, and the boss was terrible. The boss would always fire people. They made a slightest mistake. You did one thing wrong, you were out. But it was a very well-known magazine, very well-respected, big company. And it was a great job to have. And my friend, he had to do the hiring, you know. And he went around, you know, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, advertisements in the paper, and he met these people. And after a while, he said to them, look, it's a great job, but don't sell your house. Don't take your kids out of school. Most people last 3 months. And he said, everybody said no, they were going to be different. They were going to last the course. It is this hope. You tell people you're going to get nothing, they won't believe you. I sit here in white and I tell you, you can be on this path for 20 years and you will get nothing. You say, ah, he's just trying to trick us. But that is the last greatest secret. There isn't a secret. There isn't anything to get. There is everything to lose. And that is why your dreams also have to trick you. They have to take you between the lines of life, where things are not as they appear. And learning to listen to dreams, you learn to listen to this subtext. It's a very, very beautiful subtext. It is. It is about the destiny of the soul. This has to do with what is called the golden thread. Robert Johnson wrote a wonderful book called Balancing Heaven and Earth, which is about this golden thread. This golden thread that is the thread of our spiritual destiny, the thread of our soul's life. Because our soul's life is quite different to the life of the ego. And one of the reasons we work with dreams is to learn to find the thread of our soul's life. Not the ego with all of its desires for success and failure, let alone spiritual success or spiritual failure, which is a whole other ego trip of limitless proportions. And working with dreams, we learn to catch the thread. We learn to follow it. This isn't, you see, guidance, we have this understanding, somebody tells us what to do. That is, we are children, we need to be told what to do. This is the whole image from the patriarchal era. God is in heaven, we are his children, good or bad or indifferent. I think that whole era is over. I don't think there is anybody to tell us what to do because I think we have to cooperate. It is about relationship. It is about, yes, taking responsibility for ourselves. It's like to take responsibility for your dreams. Many people have dreams, but do they take responsibility for them? Do they actually live their dream or do they just listen to it? Working with dreams, it's important to realize there are different sorts of dreams. Our teacher said, he said, it is important to know from where the dream comes. There are, first of all, there are mind dreams. Just as the cow chews the cud, the mind goes over the events of the last day. It's very important for our mental balance, these mind dreams. You know, you have dreams of the people you saw the last few days or the movie or whatever it is. You can forget them. Usually you do forget them, luckily. They don't matter. Then there are dreams that belong to our personal psyche. You know the dreams with your mother and your aunt and your all of those dreams to do with your own personal psychological unfolding. In our group, we don't discuss those. People are left to work those out on their own. Those are the sort of dreams you take to your therapist, you have a therapist, or you find your own way through them. You learn how to work with them. There's a very, very good book by Robert Johnson called Inner Work, which has two parts of it. One is active imagination, the other is dream work. And just how to work with your dreams. And then personal psychological dreams, then you get into the archetypal realm, and this is when the soul begins to make its imprint. The soul begins to speak to you in this ancient language of symbols. For example, somebody who had a dream in which he was being kissed by a man. It is the most wonderful experience. It's not sexual, just a pure feeling of love in the heart. It touches me very deeply. But then I feel a tongue in my mouth. It is not his tongue. I open my eyes and see that I am embracing a serpent, and it is the serpent's tongue in my mouth. I feel very frightened. The serpent is, of course, one of the greatest archetypal symbols of the energy of the unconscious. It is also the energy of transformation. Usually, snake dreams or serpent dreams have to do with energy of transformation unless it's a green snake. So just be aware, if you have a green snake in your dream, be careful. So that is when this archetypal dimension of ourselves, I spoke yesterday about different levels of reality, you begin to connect with this inner dimension. And this has a lot of energy and a lot of power, and that is why it is frightening. And often it takes you into the darkness, into the world of the shadow, which is where the psychological transformation takes place. I've written one book called Catching the Thread, which is about psychological transformation from a Jungian Sufi perspective. So I'm not going to go into it in detail, but that describes the whole of the stages of the alchemical process as they take place within you. And this transformation. For example, another dream. I am with another woman. A man comes and fires a gun into my heart. I am taken to a stone and lie there while women mourn about me. Then I see that the skin about my left breast hangs down like the flap, and underneath are the petals of a flower. This is a very, very beautiful dream about how a certain violation by the masculine, the woman was actually abused by her father, led through love and acceptance to transformation. The petals of the flower that open from underneath the suffering. And part of this archetypal inner world here is the inner partner, the inner figures, masculine or feminine figures that you encounter in dreams. And a lovely example a friend had a little while ago. She's a young woman. Suddenly I had a beautiful dress on and lay in the arms of the most handsome, beautiful, charming, cultivated, strong, powerful, elegant, sexy, sensitive, attractive, masculine, wise, intelligent, trustworthy, and so much else man one can imagine. Do you want me to repeat that? Thank you. Kissing him, my lips tasted the sweetest thing, and I knew I was lost. Who cares about spiritual life when you can have that? So this is about this real inner relationship that begins to take place in the psyche. This has again to do with the alchemical inner transformation. It's very beautiful, it's quite wonderful, and you experience it in dreams. It is real. This belongs, as I said, to this archetypal dimension. And finally, the self, the higher self, begins to become constellated in the psyche. I just give you a lovely dream of the higher self. I am a young Irish girl living with a family. I am in love with the sun. I go into the room to see him and discover that he has a twin, although I hadn't known it before. They are lying on the bed and I look out of the window behind them. There is a beautiful man of glowing green, made of a tree, or a tree made of him. Branches come out of his fingers. This is when we enter this mythic dimension of our own self and the whole relationship of the twin. We have a twin made of light that leads to this archetypal figure of Khidr, who is also the tree of life, who is also the self. And you know, one can talk about this for days and for hours. It's wonderful that this, again, comes to us through our dreams. We are open to this archetypal world that takes us into the realm of the self, this natural glowing green being who is also a tree, who is also life itself, but reconnects us with our roots, with our own self. And part of the journey is this unfolding that happens inwardly, that we glimpse in dreams. They tell us the story of our psyche. And so there are all these levels of dreams that go from the personal psyche right through the collective psyche, the archetypal world, to the self, and how that moves and changes and evolves. And then, as I mentioned, there are dreams of the path, like this woman meeting these travelers. These are not psychological dreams. They have a different quality. They point out the spiritual path to follow. And then there are teaching dreams, which are given from self to self. Many people have them, they aren't. I dreamt that I was sitting in front of my teacher and I said to him, "I love you." And he said, very slowly and tenderly, "Someday, my dear, not one of those three little words will remain." Isn't that beautiful? "I love you. Someday, my dear, not one of those three little words will remain." Not the I, not the you. All gone. All gone. Blown away. Another dream. The teacher is helping some young women who are sitting on bar stools to die. She says there are five things. It won't take too long. It won't be too difficult. You have to do it alone. You have to be willing. You need complete trust. Isn't that nice? Sitting on bar stools, because this is the Tavern of Ruin. This has to do with all the Sufi imagery of intoxication, drunk with the wine from the eyes of the beloved. We die through his love. And again, the dreams tell us this ancient process. You don't even have to have read any Sufi books, ever been to a Sufi meeting, and these dreams will come from the psyche, because somewhere you are connected to this tradition of lovers, and this language of love, these images of love, run through your blood, appearing at a particular moment in your life. It's wonderful to see, to watch, to see how the dreams connect our consciousness to this ancient process of love and annihilation. And they are our dreams. Nobody told us them. I think so many of us are tired with being told what to do. But our dreams belong to us. They are our stories. They are this golden thread of the destiny of our soul, nobody else's. Nobody can take them away from us. We just have to learn to listen to them. We have to learn to open, because they want to speak to us. We have to learn to listen to what they told us. A very wonderful Jungian who I had the privilege to meet, he died a few years ago, Dr. Engel. He was the only person I ever met who actually was knew Carl Jung and Emma Jung quite well. It was for me like a living connection to that whole Jungian tradition. And I used to meet him in New York. He had a wonderful office overlooking Central Park that was full of books and books and books and books and books and newspapers and magazines and books. And he said, "The dream will always make itself known. Trust the dream. Listen, the dream will always make itself known." We have to learn to trust what we don't understand, what we can't grasp with our logical mind. It's like a love affair. You have to learn to trust it. It has, of course, to do with trusting your own inner self, trusting this ancient wisdom that belongs to us, but which we have pushed aside. Particularly, actually, the Puritans gave the last stamp when they rejected the whole symbolic world, and they cut us off from this symbolic language in our psyche. They had their reasons, that's fine. But we have to reclaim it. We have to redeem our own symbolic self, which has always been this connection, this plane between the world of the senses and the transcendent world, has always been the symbolic world. And part of the difficulty in our culture is we have seen there is a transcendent God and there is us here, and we have lost this connecting link. And for me, spiritual dream work is a way to regain this connecting link, this Jacob's ladder through which the angels can go up and down. So we can go from here to there and back again, and life can go from here to there, flow freely. We can reclaim our own inner spiritual heritage, which is there waiting for us. And then there are also dreams that are experiences on another plane, because, as I mentioned yesterday, in the night, the king is not in his castle, the prisoner is not in his cell. And one can have experiences on other planes of reality in the night. And you aren't caught in the confines of logical consciousness or of the ego consciousness. I just read one. In some state of consciousness beyond dreaming, I knew I was merging with the One. I could feel myself being gently pulled out of myself, moving towards some vast ocean of ineffable bliss. Something in me resisted because I was afraid, but it was only the vestige of fear. Suddenly I felt a pair of vast but incredibly gentle hands underneath me, and they pushed me onwards with such tenderness that it was impossible to resist. I saw nothing, only an impenetrable blackness, which was yet suffused with some unseen light. And I realized that I could not merge with this of my own will, that at the final stage, those vast, gentle hands come to push you gently into the blackness. And all you have to do is surrender totally to that infinite love which wants only to draw you to itself. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that just... And you know what is interesting? You wouldn't know it. The dreamer, if I remember who it is somebody in conscious life racked with anxiety and lack of self-worth, and, you know? And yet suddenly her soul speaks to her of this other mystery, of this other part of herself, this ancient lover, being drawn to the beloved, this merging into love, this absorption in love. It's all there, it's waiting to be lived. It's already being lived, but waiting to be brought into conscious knowing. And the dream is like a bridge between this world and the other, between the world of the soul, where the real spiritual mysteries take place. You see, one thing we have forgotten in our culture is that the spiritual transformation doesn't happen to us, not the you or I. My teacher, Baisab, he was a great, great master who had realized God. And he was talking to some people, and they said, Baisab, have you realized God? Have you realized yourself? And he said, no. And when they had left, Mrs. Tweedy was sort of upset by his answer. And she said, but Baisab, you are a great master, you are one with God. You said you hadn't realized God, you hadn't realized the self. And he said, but there is nobody to realize anything. The ego, the you or I, does not realize anything. It can't. This hasn't been understood enough. It can't. It would end up in mental hospital. It would get shattered by the light of a million suns. It is not meant to realize anything. It's meant to go shopping. It's meant for driving the kids to school. It is not designed for spiritual life. It doesn't belong to the soul. You develop it to be in this world. That is where it is needed to function. Yes, after many years on the path, it does become transformed so that it doesn't interfere. It surrenders. It says yes. It bows down its head. But it cannot have a mystical experience. It is not designed to have a mystical experience. When you come back, you are still yourself. Something else in you, what the Sufis call the substance within the heart of hearts, that is both the traveler and the path, that can unite with God. That can merge into the emptiness. That can be filled with bliss upon bliss. Yes, but not you or I. No. Because otherwise, it would break the ego structure apart. That is why it is one needs patience on the path. Because the ego has to learn to step aside, has to learn to want nothing, has to learn to allow this other dimension to live. And dreams prepare us for it, gently, slowly. Later, one can have those experiences in full consciousness, not the consciousness of the ego. The ego steps aside. You step out of the ego for however long you need, whether it's a minute or an hour, to step, to go into the other dimension of yourself. Then you can have those experiences in full consciousness, yes. But that takes time, because the ego has to learn to surrender, has to be purified to a certain degree. But the dreams prepare us for it. They begin to hint to us of this other shore where the sun never sets, of this part of ourself that belongs to God, that is in service to God, that witnesses God. For example, in Sufism, the witness is not you or I. No. The witness is the self. It's like when I was younger, I read that the old Sufis never slept. They always prayed. You should pray consciously, 24 hours a day. Pray continually. I tried it. I was young, I was enthusiastic, I was half crazy. I did it for about 4 or 5 days. Then I kind of collapsed. You need to sleep. Then I realized that to pray continually means something else entirely. It is when the heart is awake. Once the heart is awake, it prays 24 hours a day. When you are asleep, it is also praying. It is not you or I. We stay here. We are involved in life. We try to better our environment. We try to do the best we can. Yes, that is good work for the ego. But the real spiritual journey takes place somewhere else. And our dreams open a doorway, a window, to this other world. And at the beginning, the perfume from this other world comes through. Like the Sufis say, you scent the musk of the musk deer, and then your attention gets turned, and then you begin to look through the window, and you see a reflection of what is on the other side of the window. And that encourages you to do the practices, to undertake this ancient journey of no return. And when needed, the self speaks to you. It sends messages of love and devotion through the window. When you are asleep, when your conscious mind can't interfere. And so slowly, you are prepared for real spiritual life, which happens, the Sufis say, within the heart of heart. So we have a little break for 10 minutes, and then we have time for people to share dreams. So.
She's even writing it down.
Be irresponsible means to let God do the work. People in this culture make far too much effort. And the effort is all about them doing the right thing. And you can, what is the most dangerous, and this has not been explained in the contemporary spiritual literature, is you can constellate the ego on a higher level of reality. You get a spiritual ego that does the right thing, and it's much more difficult to get rid of. I always say, if you want to have, you know, have an ego, have a good worldly ego, you know, that likes a nice car or whatever it is, to have a spiritual ego is so much more difficult to get rid of, because it actually exists on a spiritual dimension, and then you have to undermine it spiritually. And there are not very many teachers around who know how to undermine people spiritually. They can undermine them in a worldly sense. That is easier, to undermine people spiritually, particularly if they've really put effort into their spiritual practice, is much, much more difficult. And they become very good, very sincere spiritual speakers, seekers. They have spiritual experiences on that level in which they have constellated themselves. And they can have experiences of bliss and even a few, you know, transpersonal experiences. And many groups function entirely on that level. And very safe. They don't realize it's a total illusion. Yeah? But it's good, sincere spirituality, most advisable. Mysticism is much too dangerous for most people. It's the last thing they want to know about. I always put people off. Because it isn't about you. It's about the beloved. And most people, after the first few years, make their spiritual practices about themselves. And this is a very, very big misunderstanding. And I think what actually happened is a lot of the spiritual teachings that came to this country in the 70s got caught in the self-developmental movement. And self-development is a wonderful thing for people who want to develop themselves. It works. You can develop yourself. You can have a more developed self. You can have a more creative life. You can get in touch with your feminine side or your masculine side or your creativity, or your sense of self-worth, or you can become empowered. Great, very helpful. It has absolutely nothing to do with spirituality or mysticism. And somehow the two got locked together, and a lot of what supposedly were spiritual practices were corrupted to become self-developmental practices. And nobody was around to tell people, this is a big spiritual illusion. It's one of the reasons I wrote this book, The Signs of God, because I have a strong feeling that a lot of people who are very sincere in their spiritual practice can't see what needs to be seen because their spiritual practice has become focused on themselves. Not because they have done anything wrong, not because they are bad people, usually because they are good people. Usually because they are too sincere. Because they do it too well.
Don't you think there's usually a breakthrough?
Breakdown. No. 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 No, I don't. I'd be very interested to discover. You see, for example, in the Sufi tradition, there is this point where the teacher has to betray you. You have to have a teacher who's good enough to betray you. And most people aren't prepared to take that step. They do good work, these people. And, you know, but in the end it's about them. In the very last resort it's about them. They go to heaven. Heaven is very nice. See, that's why I love this dream about the woman walking down the dusty road who met these two travelers in suits, you know, and they were gamblers. And because to me that is real. They are gamblers. You're going to lose everything. But it's best to keep away. Keep away from Sufis. They'll trick you. They'll deceive you. All of your expectations have to go. It's interesting, one can give up one's outer attachments, that is easy. To give up your expectations, your beliefs, that is more difficult. To give up everything you hoped for. I used to be a very sincere spiritual seeker. I remember saying that to Mrs. Tweedy once. And she said, yes, my dear, it's a crutch you need at the moment. Then I had this vision in which I saw a coffin on which was written spiritual aspirant. You've got to be able to laugh at yourself. That's what Joe Miller, he said, for spiritual life you need four things, you know, common sense, more common sense, and a sense of humor. And somebody asked him, you know, what is the fourth thing? And he said, even more common sense. But you need sense of humor too. It's a joke. It's a joke. You don't realize that. You know, there isn't a punchline at the end. Mrs. Tweedy used to have this friend, Hanka, she was Polish, and her English accent was never quite that good. And she used to tell these long jokes in this sort of Polish-English accent. And she always forgot the punchline, but it didn't matter. You get taken for a ride. On Sufi path, you get taken for a ride. You get ripped off at every corner. You never get what you want. Because you get something else. You have to allow yourself to be deceived. And for a lot of people in the West, that is very difficult. We are conditioned to feel we have a right to the truth. Hey, I like this. Go on. The truth is far too dangerous for most people. They like, you know, a picture book truth. Anyway, enough of that. We have like one or two more dreams if somebody wants to share. Just you have to speak up and you have to speak right into the microphone. Can we turn it up because of the storm?